Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I am Ben.
Just Ben.
Sounded like I was going to say something.
I really did. I thought you were going to launch into some incredible diatribe about today's topic, but instead, I was met with nothing.
Hey, you know, I talk a lot, so every so often you've got to let the room breathe.
Oh, you know what? If you were to run a stopwatch on our episodes, I'm sure that I would far outweigh you. I feel like I'm over here blabbering all day long, but today maybe we'll both blabber on a little bit about some interesting Australian-built vehicles.
Yes, 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 ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, if you are in the United States, you are in Australia or anywhere in the world, maybe you're an astronaut, maybe you're in orbit, we hope you will enjoy this episode of Car Stuff. We have been checking out some great topics that come to us from Australia just over the years.
We have a huge following in Australia. This is, I don't know why they find this strange, but we do. We seem to get a lot of listener response from Australia. They love us over there. And you know, we appreciate it, of course. Mm-hmm. So we try to work a few Australian topics into the mix occasionally, right? We've done Ute shows. We've done the Bathurst. Yeah, the Bathurst 1000, mm-hmm. the road trains episode. You're right. We talked about kangaroo dummies used in crash tests. We've talked about a bunch of Australian stuff, but today we're going to take it a different way with Australian production vehicles. And I may think that we're just going to be talking about Ford and Holden and Toyota because those are the ones that are typically associated with Australia.
Not so.
No, there's the continent has a much bigger and broader automobile history than that, than just those three brands. I mean, that's a big history to begin with, but there's a lot of what we'll call strange vehicles in Australia's auto manufacturing past.
Right, and Australian listeners may be surprised to find that even you might find a new vehicle today that you haven't heard of, because some of these are deep cuts, man, honestly.
Oh, definitely. We're going to talk about some very low production number vehicles that are coming out of Australia from, the last 60 or 70 years, I think. So there's some surprises here, even for people that live in Australia, as you mentioned, but definitely for the rest of the world.
Yeah, we're going to jump around in time a little bit, and we hope that we find some things that are surprising to you. We know that we're going to find some things that are surprising to our listeners outside of Australia. So let's just dive into it. What's first on the list?
First on the list is the Adair Sportif. This is a car, this is very, very low production. As we said, there were just 12 of these built.
Right. Yeah. And the story behind it is fascinating, if not funny. This was based on the VH Commodore. There's a firm there in Melbourne called the Classic Car Craft, and they created the Sportif. It's two doors, using parts of a German Opel Rekord, and that's something that the early Commodores were based upon themselves.
Yeah, it's got other parts as well. There's the headlights from the Ford Fairlane. It's a strange car, so it's a Holden car that they're putting a new body on, really. And it's built by a company called Classic Car Craft.
Mm-hmm.
And Classic Car Craft described the Sportif as the car General Motors Holden should have built. And it's funny that they say this,
right?
Because they only built 12 of them, right? And I think a lot of people really didn't like this car. I mean, obviously, it didn't really catch on. But, you know, with 12 examples sold, I don't think you could really have the, huevos to say that General Motors should have built this vehicle, or the Holden company should have built this car.
Right. Yeah. And we saw that a lot of times, the big talkers are the first to falter when they walk. The Holden VH Commodore itself is a pretty darn good vehicle. Mm-hmm. I mean, released October 1981. And, you know, it's the evolution of the previous Commodore, the VC model. This is a car that you see around everywhere. So it makes sense to me that this would be a good beginning for an experiment.
Yeah, sure. We'll find a lot of the companies do that. They rebody a car. They take, elements that they like from other vehicles and put them together and say, oh, like this one did, and said, oh yeah, this is the car that you should have built. People are going to love this. And then in fact, with 12 built, failed on the in the marketplace.
Well, let's move on to the next one.
Sure.
The Bolwell.
I like this one. This is maybe the coolest looking one on the entire list. I really like all of the different models and makes of this one, because there were 9 different models, and they're very similar in design, I guess, but they go from Mark 1 through about Mark 8, and then I was confused by that, because it says 9 models, but it goes Mark 1 to Mark 8.
Right.
Later, they revealed a Mark 10, which is kind of strange, a Nagari model. They called it Mark 10 Nagari, and it was revealed in 2008, and it had a starting price that was north of $200,000. Now, this is an interesting vehicle because the mechanicals were borrowed from several different manufacturers. Engines came from Ford, Holden, and Volkswagen for this car.
Yeah, and Bolwell has a fascinating, unexpected story because, as we said, they're an Australian company, and they originally produced sports cars for a very short amount of time.
Yeah, just from, 1962 through 1979, so what, about 17 years?
Yeah, and this is the part where someone's saying, Scott, Ben, hang on, guys. You said that they had a new car coming out in 08.
Yeah, that's right. And I think in 2009, they actually started building this car. And
right.
I don't even know if they're still in production. I haven't really dug into it enough to find that out, but I can tell you what it looks like, because I did look up the vehicle that they revealed in 2008. And the best way to describe it is sort of like a Lotus Elise, maybe, but not exactly. It's a little bit different in the way it, the back end is treated. But if you want to look at the older Bolwell designs, they kind of look like the Datsun cars.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Maybe like the 240, the 280Z, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah, the Bolwell Nagari, Nagari is an aboriginal word that means flowing, mm-hmm. Was the first full production car that Bowl had, sports car at least. They only made 100 coupes and 18 convertibles.
Wow, so pretty low production again. So talking of about 118 total,
mm-hmm.
that's it? That's extremely low. So let's move on to the next one on the list, unless you got more on Bolwell that we need to know.
Oh, no, I think we've got others to get to, and honestly, I'm saving some good stuff about Bolwell for a possible podcast in the future.
Oh, yeah, because it's an interesting car. It definitely looks cool.
Oh, that's what we should say. Guys, if you hear a vehicle that we mention that you would like to hear more about or you think would make a good episode for a podcast, go ahead and send us an email.
Ah, yes, and here's another car that is still in production today. This is called the Bufori.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Bufori or Bufori, maybe?
I think Bufori.
Bufori. Now, this is weird. This is an acronym, B-U-F-O-R-I. It's an acronym for beautiful, unique, fantastic, original, romantic, and irresistible. So you would think that this car would just be the car to end all cars, right?
Yeah, to me, not speaking Italian at first, I wondered, is this for some reason an Italian word? And I felt like a nincompoop, a dunderhead, when I figured out there was an acronym, when I found that part, because it reminded me of Häagen-Dazs ice cream, which I don't know if that's everywhere else in the world or if it's just in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that word means nothing, right?
That's what I've heard. Yeah,
yeah.
It's just a way to sell the product.
The guy made it up because he said, oh, this sounds fancy.
Sure. Yeah.
So I got Häagen-Dazs on this, but Bufori themselves, they started building, a Madison with a VW engine in 1986,
yeah,
these three brothers.
And they still build cars. They still build them, but not in Australia. They moved the production to Malaysia in 1998, and they build two different models now. I think they had three different models that were built in Australia. They built the Madison, they built one called the V6i,
mm-hmm.
and then the Mark II.
Yeah, and now, based in Malaysia, they're building the LaGioia and the Geneva models.
Exactly right. So that's the Malaysian production. And I guess the best way to describe these, because I went online and took a look at the two cars that are around today. I mean, these have kind of the classic coach-style look, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Maybe, you know, like a long front end and, you know, two-seater. Very little or no trunk, but, you know, that long, long hood with maybe the rolling fenders and, you know, the spare tire mounted on those fenders on the front.
Oh, yeah.
Great big headlights. It's kind of a classic look. But the newer vehicles, the Geneva and
LaGioia.
LaGioia or LaGioia. I don't know what
LaGioia.
It is. Probably LaGioia. It kind of looks like a cross between a Rolls Royce and a Morgan Aero Coupe. It's not a particularly attractive car in my mind, but I don't know. It's not Bufori. And the LaGioia or the LaGioia is very similar in style. So they're not dramatically different between the two makes, two models rather, but I would bet there's a cost difference is probably where it's at, you know, with the accessories, et cetera.
Oh, yeah, I bet. Let's go on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting one.
The Bullet.
Yeah, the Bullet. This is almost, well, you could just say that this is a Mazda MX-5, right?
So. Right. Yeah. These are rotary powered, rechassied MX-5.
Yeah, you're right. But the difference is that they alter these. They modify these, right?
Yeah,
so these
yeah.
are, they take the Mazda MX-5 or what we call the Miata here in the States.
Uh-huh.
They modify them, with, in some cases, a giant Lexus V8.
Right.
So these are very powerful kits. Oftentimes supercharged.
Mm-hmm.
So extremely powerful small sports cars. It's always been a popular combination.
Right. And this is a recent addition because people familiar with this, you'll recall that they started mid-90s, I guess, mm-hmm. and the Lexus V8 engine starts coming in around the 2000s, but they still specialize in these kits and they apparently word on the street is they have a new supercar in the works.
Yes. And I went to their site. I went to the Bullet site and you can go to bulletcars.com for updates on this, but they haven't really announced any kind of body style. They haven't shown you what they're going to do yet, but they're saying that they're not going to use the MX-5, donor body anymore. They're going to create a brand new supercar. So again, all new style. They're going to continue to build these high performance supercars, but, it's going to have a new look.
Yeah, and this, I went to the website as well. This is something that is definitely worth looking at if you are a supercar fan.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not a fan of supercars, I'm surprised. I mean, as Fleetwood Mac says, go your own way, but seriously, supercars are awesome.
That's funny, Ben. It's like you're saying, you gotta see it my way.
Well, I mean, just not necessarily my way.
Well, it's my way or the highway.
It's the right way.
So maybe you've influenced me.
Oh, man, I'm going to get some letters
maybe,
for
but
that one.
But bulletcars.com, they definitely have some great cars to check out there. So go ahead and do it.
Next up on our list, the Gio Cotolo, which I'm mispronouncing. It's a low-volume vehicle, right?
Yeah.
And it was manufactured by the Gio Cotolo Motori. It's a low-volume vehicle and it was produced by an Italian company named Gio Cotolo Motori. This is interesting. The name is Italian for what, Scott?
Toy. It's called a toy. So it's outright saying this is just a toy car. It's not for everyday use or whatever, but this vehicle is from the mid 1980s. And you may think, well, that's kind of a strange era to really, think about, these incredible low production sports cars like what they're building, right? But what was happening in the mid 1980s is very important here, right? Because this was a vehicle that was intended to compete in the Group B rally competition.
Yes. And the reason this is of singular importance is because if you have listened to our episodes on Group B rally cars and the regulations that came from that, you know, that these vehicles eventually were outlawed.
Yeah, because they were just too powerful.
Yeah, they were too good and therefore too dangerous.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. And we have that whole podcast about that and, it's fascinating history, but I can tell you a little bit more about this car and then I think we'll move on to the next one. But it was the work of an entrepreneur named Paul Halstead and a former F1 designer named Barry Locke.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, it's tough to say Barry Locke. I want to say Peter Brock when I say that. Just because we're talking about Australia and design. Anyway, so it was Barry Locke who was a former F1 designer. And you can imagine this car has, quite a bit of style like the Group B rally cars of that day. I mean, it's got a giant wing on the back. It looks like it has fender flares.
Yeah.
Pretty cool looking, but again, it's the mid 1980s, so maybe not exactly what you're thinking. So incredible power out of this car. It has a 5-liter Holden V8, among mm-hmm. other things. I mean, it has a lot of different parts from different vehicles. So it has an Alfa Romeo, glass house and cabin, which means, I guess, the entire upper part of the vehicle.
Yeah.
It has Kevlar body panels and it has what they call a bespoke mid-engine chassis. So a custom chassis is what that means.
Well, get this though. There's one more thing on this one.
A weird thing.
Yeah. It has a toolkit that comes with a mini bar sized bottle of Bundaberg rum and a pair of shot glasses.
That's a strange tool to need on the side of the road, but I feel like I've needed that at some point.
I mean, we have crazy traffic here, right? and then there is the Go-Go Mobile.
Yeah, the Go-Go Mobile. Now, you may think, well, that's a German car. That's not something that, is Australian production, right? You would be wrong, because what happened was they brought in the German-made Gogomobile from, what, 1957 till about 1961?
Yeah, and this is a microcar.
Yeah, microcar. I don't know how I didn't mention that right away, but it's a microcar from post-World War II Germany. And what the Australians did was they brought it in without the body on it. They brought in just the chassis, the rolling chassis.
Yeah.
With the engine and everything and the interior. And then they rebodied it to fit their needs.
Right. Yeah. They had locally made, fiberglass bodies. And I gotta tell you, every time that I see a microcar, I chuckle a little bit. And I'm not being a jerk, but I always notice them. And I think they're neat and I think they're cool. I don't know if I would ever be in a place where I could drive one.
Yeah.
But, if you have seen one of these, then first off, you should know that you're very, very, very lucky. And secondly, I would like some photos.
Yeah. Pretty low production on these, but, again, they were rebodied with locally formed fiberglass bodies. So that's where the Australian, manufacturing comes in, I guess, to this, right?
Kind of a technicality, I'd say.
I guess so. Yeah. They built, saloon style. They built coupes. They built, coupe convertibles. And even a light van variant, and they all had 300cc and 400cc twin-cylinder engines.
Mm-hmm.
So not that powerful, but again, you don't really need anything that strong, I guess, when you're in a tiny, tiny car.
I mean, people aren't buying microcars to take them out to the salt flats.
Definitely not.
Next up, we have Hartnett, which I think will be familiar to a lot of people because this was formed by a former Holden boss, Lawrence Hartnett, way back in 1949.
That's right. The idea was to challenge Holden's market dominance, which is kind of funny now when we think about what's going on.
Yeah, but it came from the prime minister at the time.
Yeah, the prime minister. The guy's name was Ben Chiefley. And Ben said that, there was just too much market dominance going on through from Holden at the time. We need something new to compete. And this guy from Holden, you know, this former Holden boss, his name was Lawrence Hartnett, as you mentioned, decided, well, the way to do it is just to start up our own company. We're going to call it Hartnett. And they made a couple of different models. They made the Tasman sedan and the Pacific convertible. Now, Tasman, I can kind of think, I'm guessing that it comes from the Tasman Sea, which is right outside of Australia, between New Zealand and Australia. Mm-hmm. And then a Pacific, of course, is the other side. It seems to make sense the way they name these. But really very, very, very low production on these things.
Right. Yeah. There were supply issues. So the company went under in 55 after they built just around 120 cars. There were some station wagons as well that they dabbled in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it just goes to show that making cars can be a very risky business. Starting a company can be a very, very difficult business.
I did not see that they made station wagons. That's pretty cool. That's I kind of would like to see that because it had an interesting shape. I mean, it almost had a pickup truck boxy look to it. I like looking at pictures of these old Hartnett vehicles. I like looking at pictures of all these vehicles we've talked about today. But, you know, to imagine the, I guess, a wagon version of that, fascinated by wagons anyway, so maybe that's it.
Well, here's something that I think is interesting about the Hartnett or the Tasman specifically, and it's a similar issue to what plagued the Volt. All right, so the original price of this vehicle was supposed to be less than 300 pounds.
I was wondering how you're going to tie this into the Volt.
And then before production had even started, they said it'll be more around 430 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Then January 1950, they said, okay, it's going to cost less than 500 pounds, but that counts sales tax. 1951, no cars have been delivered yet. And the company said, okay, honestly, 549 pounds, and then, you know, plus sales tax. So that would make the purchase price less than 600 pounds. The first aluminum-bodied Pacific convertible sold in April in 52 cost 695 pounds, and that includes sales tax.
Wow, so they more than doubled the price of the vehicle from when they first announced the vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, it's just tough, and I'm not saying they're bad cars, but, you know, we saw the same changing expectations with the Volt pre-production.
Sure we did, yeah. It was promised at a very low level, and then it came out. It was very expensive.
Right, yeah. And this is a car, these are cars that, I don't know, they're so rare that I'd be surprised if somebody had seen seen these. Maybe I haven't looked to see if they're in a museum or anything.
No, I'm sure that there's got to be examples somewhere hanging around in museums. I know that there are. And I've seen a few of them, you know, with just 120 cars produced. I know I've seen photos of them online, so I know they're hanging around. I don't know if they're all, you know, still in Australia, if they've, you know, kind of been spread out over the world or what, but I know I've seen examples of them. I've never seen a station wagon version, though. That was surprising to me.
I want to see what other people think about this next one, the Lightburn Zeta.
Yeah,
or Zeta.
Now, this is a quirky little car, and I believe that when I went to that that microcar museum, I think I saw an example of this.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm pretty sure he had one there. It was in, Madison, Georgia?
Yeah, that guy had everything.
Yeah, the microcar museum. Anyways, it was, this is strange, Ben. It was, again, built by an appliance manufacturer named Lightburn and Company. Well, they also built cement mixers, so we can't just say they were just appliances, but they made appliances, which we found so many times in the past, you know, with, what was it, Kelvinator? Is that the one? And, who else was it? There were others, right?
Let's see. Oh, I'm thinking.
I'm putting you on the spot.
Engines. We had a lot. Tucker. Tucker was making, that was more military equipment.
Sure, yeah, military. Yeah. But I'm thinking of, like, home appliances, even kitchen appliances.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
I know we've got a short list here somewhere of...
The toaster makers.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, there's some pretty interesting manufacturers that have come out of the home appliance field. Mm-hmm. It's strange. Anyways.
It makes sense because they have the industrial base to do it.
Yeah.
But this is a funny story about this one, Scott. When I was doing some research in it, I found it on a couple of ugliest cars ever lists.
No kidding.
Yeah, which seemed
really
unfair to me. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not an absolute work of art, but I don't think it's a dog.
I don't think it deserves to be on the ugliest car list by any means. I mean, it's an unusual looking vehicle. Like I said, it's a quirky little car. This is really strange. Okay, it had no, let's just get to it here. It had no rear storage.
Yeah.
Was
no reverse gear in some of them?
Well, yeah, in most of them. There was a sports model, which is not the one we're talking about. We're talking about just the Lightburn Zeta, sedan model, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they also had a utility and in addition to the sports body. So the sports model was a little bit different, but this vehicle did not have any kind of reverse. So if you were in the car, you could imagine that's very, difficult to get around, a problem to get around, I guess, if you're in a parking lot. So what you would do is you would switch the vehicle off and the engine would be started in reverse.
Right.
And then you would have, effectively, you would have four reverse gears because it was the same forward as backwards. So whatever the top speed was in forward gear was also your top speed in reverse gear, theoretically.
The worst that could happen?
Yeah, if you could drive that, you could actually shift this car in reverse if you wanted to. I mean, from, you know, first, second, third, fourth, all the way through. Very, very strange and very low production as well. So there were something like 400 of these cars produced total, and that was it. And it had some really weird things, like the fuel tank was located behind the dashboard and had a gravity feed system. We mentioned the sports model. I think that one had a slightly bigger engine than the Zeta that we're talking about, because the Zeta model had a 324cc twin-cylinder engine, and the sports model had a what they call the big block 498cc, which is, if you think about it, their big block engine, that's about a half a liter displacement, really. It's a very small engine for what they call the sports model. And if you want to see what the sports model was adapted from, again, this is a very low production. Only 48 of those sports models were produced, and they were based on a car called the Meadows Frisky.
Mm-hmm.
So unusual vehicles, to say the least. But, check out the Lightburn Zeta sports model and the Meadows Frisky and tell us what you think about those.
Let's go back to something a little bit bigger, and let's also go back to rotary engines with the Mazda Road Pacer.
This is so weird. I can't even say this with a straight face, but this is a Mazda car. So it was sold in Japan.
Yeah, from 75 to 77.
Yeah, and it was actually shipped to Japan because it was built in Australia, and it was based on a Holden vehicle. It was built based on the Holden HJ and HX Premier. And the strange thing about this is that those cars typically had... I believe it's an inline six engine or a V8 engine. So these are great,
the big Aussie six.
Yeah, these are big vehicles. You got to picture 1970s, mid-1970s.
So what did they put?
So
in
they
there?
They shipped them to Japan without the engines.
Right.
And Japan or Mazda decided that they were going to add their 13B rotary engine, which is the Wankel engine, designed by Felix Wankel. We've talked about that in the past, but I can tell you that the power output was about the same. The horsepower output was about the same.
Yeah.
Between the 3.3 liter six cylinder engine from the Holden car, but it had way less torque.
Right. Yeah. Which meant that it was pretty slow. And of the 800 that were produced, most did not satisfy the owners. This is, however, the only rotary-engined GM product.
Yeah, it's strange that they would put this smaller Wankel engine, this rotary engine, in this giant land yacht of a vehicle when it was luxury car buyers that were looking to buy this thing.
Yeah, like fancy French cheese and Chinese food. These are two great things that don't go well together.
That's a good way to put it, Ben.
I'm hungry.
Right, so let's move on. Here's a strange one. This is one that was built as part of a challenge, which I always find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And again, low production, they built 1,000 examples back in 1981, and this is the Mitsubishi Sigma Peter Werrett Special.
Yeah, and Australian fans will notice, will of course remember Peter Werrett. Here's the challenge, at least according to the anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
He was challenged to create a better car after he complained to a Mitsubishi engineer about the way the Sigma handled.
Yeah, now Peter Werrett was a motoring and motorsport journalist. He's also a race car driver, so he knew this stuff, right? And then he went on to do other things too. I mean, I think he became the a co-writer on the show Torque, which was around, you know, from I think 1973 till about 1980. He opened his own driver training school, like, you know, post-licensed driver training school, so, you know, way to perfect your driving. I operated that until about 1980. I think it was called Peter Werrett Advanced Driving. And then he was also a pit reporter at the Bathurst 1000 in 1983.
Yeah.
But according to him, he converted the Sigma into one of the great family cars of the decade, is how he put it.
Right.
And he did this with a lot of different ways. What he did is he upped the horsepower. He went from, and this is the strangeness here between the U.S. And the Australian numbers.
Oh, the conversion.
They do the power in kilowatts. So it's 72.9 kilowatts, which is about 98 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And he upped that to about 76 kilowatts, so up to about 102 horsepower. So a minor increase, but still, I guess, significant. It's a 2.6 liter engine.
Yeah, he fixed the shock tuning, got disc brakes all around.
Yep, 5-speed manual.
Uh-huh, 15-inch alloy wheels.
Pirelli tires, and, of course, a special paint job with striped decals and all that.
Yeah, and a cosmetic kit. So he's got Recaro front seats and an autographed steering wheel by Momo.
Yeah, so, you know, anything that carries a signature like this, a special or signature edition, is usually a popular seller. And I wonder if 1,000 was just kind of the limit for them, or if it just necessarily wasn't that popular. I'm not exactly sure on the story of this, but I would think that it's just a limited production vehicle that they never intended to build more than 1,000 of.
Right, yeah. I think it was more just for the publicity and proving a point. However, there was a car that had only around 120 produced, and that was the Overlander four-wheel drive.
Yeah, this is one that was in production. Oh, man, it's actually a long production. It's from 1976 to 1989.
And only 120.
Yeah.
Just think about that.
Yeah.
This is based on the Holden HJ and HZ.
Ah, yes, that's right. Now, it did have other things, too. It had a Dana transfer case and had a front and rear off-road axles and wheels and tires and suspension that are, you know, also off-road approved. It was a it's kind of a rugged outback type vehicle, I guess. I mean, it's something intended for off-road use.
Right, yeah. And this was produced not just by Holden, but by a company in Tasmania called Vehicle Engineering and Modifications, PL.
Hmm.
So if you see one of these, even if you don't think it's the most attractive car, go ahead and pat yourself on the back because you have won the lottery of car viewing.
Yeah, there's, again, 120 produced, and the last one was produced, what, some 26 years ago now?
Mm-hmm.
So a long time ago, they had three body styles. They had a wagon, they had a ute, and then they had a kind of a heavy-duty ute, which was the one-ton version.
Mm-hmm.
And not popular at all. I mean, it just didn't sell well. They found that most people that were in the same market for something like this for the same vehicle, bought the Toyota Land Cruiser instead.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's kind of tough to take, but I guess if you see the sales numbers on the decline and you see that, you know, the people that are interested in your vehicle are going over next door to the Toyota dealership and just picking up the Land Cruiser, it doesn't take long to understand that, you know, this vehicle is not going to hang out too long. It's going to be quickly off the market.
Right. And with that, we arrive at our last obscure or strange Australian vehicle on the list. And Scott, that is the Recaro Mysteri.
Yeah, this is strange. It has another name, too, the Arcadipane taipan. Strange names right now. This is what this became, and I'll explain it in just a second. But to me, this vehicle, just to describe it, it looks a little bit like the AMC Eagle that was sold here in the United States, that 4x4 AMC Eagle car.
Yeah.
Very similar to it. And this is a 1977 concept from the Sydney Motor Show. And it's the designer, this is somebody interesting, I guess.
Oh, yeah, Peter Arcadipane.
Yeah, Peter. Now, Peter is the guy that was responsible for designing. He was a Ford designer at one time, and he designed the Mad Max Interceptor, or he helped design the Mad Max Interceptor for the film, the one that we're talking about in the film. And that car was a 1973 XB GT Ford Falcon Coupe, and it was kind of a high-performance police interceptor car that was, you know, built for the film, intended to look pretty evil-looking. You know, it's kind of a dangerous look to
pretty,
it.
Pretty mean on the road.
Exactly right. So this is the guy that's building this vehicle or was aiding in the design of this vehicle.
Right. And this vehicle itself, the Mysteri, was built from a Holden Torona, and that ultimately gave rise to the Taipan body kit. But here's the interesting thing. This was originally, we saw it as a concept car. It was just supposed to be a one-off car that allowed Recaro to showcase some of their stuff.
Ah, yes. But it had other variations, too. It wasn't just a Torana hatchback, right? It had a chop tail. It had a shovel nose design. It also had wheel arch flares, which I find very attractive, as we all know.
We had also found that the Taipan went through several different iterations of the body kit, right? Mm-hmm. And you can get a version called the Bobcat. You can get one with NACA ducts on it. You can also see variations on the nose and the hatch at the end. But I think one thing that's interesting here is to ask ourselves, what happened to the cars that this guy was designing? You know, like, how far did he take it?
Yeah, well, the plan was for low volume production numbers, but the plan, however, you know, they had laid it out, it just didn't add up completely. And eventually they said, well, we've got a good design here, we got to do something with it. And they sold the body kits as something they called the Taipan kit through Arcadipane's coach building business. So there's a way to get a kit to make your vehicle, your Torana based hatchback, look just like this one.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. And also, this is completely tangential, but this is something I'm excited enough about to end the podcast on. Scott, you know about the new Mad Max coming out, right?
I do, and I've seen just very little of it so far, though. But some of the vehicles that they've shown.
Yeah, the vehicles.
Amazing.
So what I would like to do is follow up in the future with an update on the cars of Mad Max. Maybe we can start with the Interceptor in the original and walk all the way up to the newest Mad Max.
I would love to do that. I'm a huge fan of that movie, and I think that some of the newer ones that I've seen, I've just seen a glimpse of some of them, you know, what they're showing us now. And I really, really like this.
And we hope that you enjoyed checking out this show. This is one of those episodes that I feel like is a rabbit hole, you know, and it's very easy to fall down into the history of some of these cars. As we said earlier, write to us and let us know if you want us to do an entire episode on one of these. And it just might happen. In the meantime, you can check out carstuffshow.com to see every episode we've ever done. We even have some videos up because we're moving on up in the world. If you want to see some stuff that doesn't quite make it to the show, please do follow us. We are Carstuff HSW on Facebook, on Twitter. Super easy. And I don't know, we're pretty funny. We get our chuckles in sometimes.
Occasionally.
All right. Well, if you have some advice for us about jokes we should be making, topics we should be covering, yeah.
I think you're a funny guy, but mine fall a little flat sometimes.
Are you kidding? I'm clearly not the brains of this comedy operation.
You tell jokes in here all the time. In fact, before our podcast, sometimes you're telling jokes we're cracking up. It's hard to even go on the air sometimes.
Well, you know, some of those jokes can't go on the air, Scott.
That's true. That's true.
Good point. So that's a very good point that you made. If you have any jokes that can be on the air, then please feel free to mail them along with a topic suggestion to our address. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.